ANZ Voices welcomes you to the Business of Bluntstock podcast with Tim Rowe and Charmaine Bukovec.
On episode 14 of the ANZ Business of Bloodstock podcast, proudly supported by Jimmy Unwell as a Vesta Bloodstock, myself, Justin Darcy, and co-host Tim Rowe are joined by Kestrel Thoroughbreds Bruce Slade, where we talk all things Newgate, Kestrel Thoroughbreds, and Talloc Lodge.
We're lucky enough for the latest episode of the Business of Bloodstock podcast. We've got Kestrel Thoroughbreds Bruce Slade with us. Welcome to the podcast, Bruce.
Yeah, Tim, Justin, thanks. Very much for having me, guys. I'm excited to talk about the business of Bloodstock. I like the fact that you've sort of gone down this track. You know, the fact is that we're all in the sport for the horse, but it's also it's a very big business, and we're making decisions, I suppose, every day that are either putting us in a very good position or a very bad position. So it's a great challenge of the industry and the game, and it's cool that you guys cover this on the podcast.
Thanks, Bruce. I think, you know, we're lucky that we've had some very good guests on here, and the horses, yes, they're important, but it's generally the industry is about people as well. And Bruce, you've got an interesting sort of backstory as well. No one ends up where they are now without, you know, doing a lot of hard work and, you know, 20 years to become an overnight success and things like that. And you've certainly done that, Bruce, and worked your way up to where you are now.
Yeah, thanks, Tim. Yeah, I think that the grounding, even though you probably don't realize it at the time, the grounding, having a good idea by about the age of 13 that this is what I wanted to do when I was going to make my way in a professional capacity in this industry was a huge help. You know, it just allowed me to every weekend I was working down the stables at Ricken Racecourse there in Christchurch. Every holidays I was traveling to the North Island of New Zealand to do yearling prep. You know, it just allowed me to, I suppose it's like anything, you know, you read about the top sports people, the top people in industries, and it's repetitions and it's hours and it's, you know, that 10,000 hour rule which they discuss. And when you look back at it, you think, wow, you know what, like I probably had such a benefit of starting early, of getting a lot of repetitions in on the breeding front, on the training front, through the sales companies, and been very, very lucky to see a lot in my time on earth so far.
Obviously you spent a fair bit of time in New Zealand, but you're actually South African, I believe. Can you sort of give us a bit of your background and family background? There's a bit of a sad story there, I believe, as well. But you know, you're here to tell the tale.
Yeah, a blessed life really, Tim. Like I was born in South Africa, obviously. Mum and a sister, my father was killed when I was very young in South Africa, just typical sort of South Africa at the time, and unfortunately even probably worse now, but had an incredibly brave mother, a courageous mother who left her family and friends to get us out of South Africa as a single parent, and she got us thankfully to New Zealand, where we met up with an uncle of mine, John Slade, who had managed actually farms in South Africa, had nearly been murdered himself in South Africa, and hence got out, made his way to England, then New Zealand, and set up a stud there. So we essentially ended up, me, my mum, and my sister, living in a what we call a warri in New Zealand, which is a sort of side house about 5 meters by 5 meters with a double bed, shower, kitchen, and you know, just had the great upbringing on the farm through my sort of teenage years. You know, living on the farm, being around the horses. We had some deer, some sheep, and obviously big wide open expanses, but more than anything had security, you know, had a roof over our heads and had the security of New Zealand where you don't have to lock your door, which was a huge shock to my mum at the time, you know, who used to carry a gun under her pillow, and when she heard a noise outside, she'd have to sort of go outside with the gun, and my sister and I would hide under the bed and wait for her to come back, sort of thing, you know. So we approached the move to New Zealand with a lot of gratitude and with the view that you know, we were lucky to be there, thanks to my mum and thanks to the New Zealand government, essentially, and we're going to try and make the most of it.
How old were you at that stage when your father was killed and you moved out to New Zealand?
Oh, so I was young when my father was killed. I was 3. We didn't get out of New Zealand and South Africa until I was 11. So a bit of a lag time in there with again, my uncle's also leaving South Africa, and they left at a later date. So, yeah, had a good considerable amount of time in South Africa growing up from birth to sort of 11, and then from New Zealand from 11 to about 21, and then Australia thereon.
And just a little bit about how you got actually involved in racing as well. I mean, as we mentioned before, you've established quite the career for yourself, but how did that interest actually begin in the sport of racing and bloodstock?
Yeah, Justin, didn't have really any exposure to it until getting to New Zealand, where my uncle was an incredibly good stud master, incredibly talented, you know, raiser of young horses. He used to manage Summerhill Farm in South Africa, which was a very big farm there, and actually went back to manage Main Chance Farm in South Africa. And I mean, they were doing things like trifectoring the J&B Met and things like that, which is like breeding the trifecta or raising the trifecta of the Cox Plate type thing, right? He was quite a, I wouldn't say socially awkward, but he was a guy that much more enjoyed his time around horses than he did people. And I would sort of, he just became like a father figure for me, right? I suppose in New Zealand, landed there, he became almost like a father figure to me, and I learned a lot from him. But, you know, where his strengths were the horses, his weaknesses were maybe the people. And you know, we'd have people turn up to see the stallions on the farm, and he'd go and hide, literally hide in the bushes, and send me out to go and greet the guests and show them the stallion, that kind of thing, right? So it was quite an amazing sort of, we made a pretty good little duo there. You know, he taught me everything, Justin. But I will say, I remember vividly the first time I watched a race. It was televised in South Africa. I must have been just flicking over the channels, and I watched London News win in Hong Kong. I'm not sure what year that was, but it would have been 38 now, and I must have been before I went to South Africa. So it must have been a good 28 years ago. And I remember watching that race and just being captured by that moment. But then again, I didn't see racing or breeding again or thoroughbreds again until we got to New Zealand.
What was your first official sort of job in racing, I guess? Where in New Zealand, they obviously touched on with your uncle, but your first paid job, I guess?
So, every school, I was very lucky, as I've said, you know, I used to be around my uncle, ask him a lot of questions. Duncan Grimley, I got to know from Coolmore. He used to send me the Coolmore brochure out, the stallion brochure every year with a personalised note. And, you know, the Coolmore brochure was such an incredible thing. I remember 1997, I reckon it was, Thunder Gulch, front cover. And you'd go through and you not only learn the horses, but you'd see all the people involved in the game as well, you know. So you'd learn so much about the wider industry from that brochure. And, you know, every school holiday I'd go to, I went to Bloomsbury Stud, Ritual Stud. I think I was definitely paid at the time, you know, it would have been sort of minimal sort of student pay. You know, that was sort of through school. And then I did a year in South Africa with my uncle after high school, went to university, at Otago University, and then was lucky enough to be given the Sunline Scholarship, which was the New Zealand scholarship. They put together a one-year scholarship, a management scholarship, which they sent you to Cheveley Park in England, Coolmore in Ireland, TaylorMade in the USA, and you're sort of working on those farms, but also, you know, sort of being shoulder to shoulder with management through your time there as well. So you're sort of getting a real good understanding of how the farm worked and the operations, and that was a great leg up to getting to my first sort of role outside of school, and that was at New Zealand Bloodstock, doing as in a marketing assistant. So my role was there like writing press releases, and did a bit of South Island bloodstock work as well, head of the South Island breeders, and did some auctioneering too, Tim and Justin. So that was a good little good interest.
I believe you were a good bid spotter, stands out, and I believe you were extremely enthusiastic, very good at it, and it captured the attention of one Gay Waterhouse. Am I correct in that assumption?
Yeah, incredible moment, turning point in my life, bid spotting at Karaka. You know, Gay just walked out of the stands down to where I was bid spotting and said, young man, I'd like to offer you a job in Sydney, come and work for me. And I said, oh, wow, Gay. She didn't even know my name. I said, wow, Gay, you know, can I think about it? She said, don't think about it, just come. So a couple of months later, I had boarded a plane, arrived in Sydney. There was no job, no title. My first role was to help edit her book, which she was writing from her blog, and we did the 3 month tour of Australia sort of thing, promoting the book, which was just something I hadn't done before. But typical Gay, you know, she sort of just throws you in there, gives you something to do, and off you go. And so many other things, Tim and Justin, like, she just knocked me into shape. She got me to David Jones and got me a suit and got me well fitted, as opposed to, you know, being sort of sloppy. Went to a Rob's hair, you know, barber, so I got a proper haircut. She thought my driving was dangerous, so she sent me to driving school. I was like 23 and a bunch of 16 and 17 year olds thinking, who's this guy? You know what I mean? Like, he must be absolutely no idea. But yeah, she just did all those little things that just knocked me into shape and really helped me, I suppose, just become a bit more refined.
Speaking of Gay as well, she's obviously a great role model to people in the industry, and certainly one of Australia's faces and racing's faces that reflect such a brilliant light on our industry. And by the sounds of it, that has come to the fore here in the perfect example with giving you this amazing opportunity and what's developed into your career as well.
Yeah, I mean, there's just no one like her, Justin, is there? You know, and I think in life, if you can work for people that inspire you, that challenge you, you know, push you to be better, you'll always be well-placed. And I think that's something we should all continue to do. You know, make sure you're surrounded by those people that are going to lift you up, whether that be in your professional life, your personal life. And Gay was certainly one of those. You know, she is, I've never seen anyone work like she can work. I've never seen her ability with horses. Her intuition was incredible. Her standards, you know, at the end of the day, it comes down to standards. And she was never going to settle for being second best. She was never going to settle for, you know, we got the job done. It always needed to be done at the very best level. And that's something that she really drove into us. And you can see so many people have come through her system and been trained that way. And it's held us in good stead going forward.
You've obviously progressed from probably being a gopher to, you know, I believe her racing manager. So you worked your way up and Gay recognised your talents.
Yeah, and still very much gopher to this day. It's one of those operations, Tim, you know, you just chip in and add value where you can, you know, like whether that be positioning yourselves to make sure the job gets done to the best of the ability. And that might mean driving her around in the golf cart for a little bit, or writing a few notes for her to make sure that we keep it on track, or whatever needed doing, you do, you know, just to keep the whole train on the tracks, so to speak. So, no, it's been just an absolute blessing working for Gay and having so much great access to her, you know.
Obviously, your talents were then recognised by Henry Field, who I believe also sort of came through the school of Gay, for want of a better phrase, and you sort of got tied up with, well, even before that, you sort of launched a bit of a syndication business with your now wife as well, Roundtable Racing, and then ended up at Newgate.
Yeah, and not always successful, sometimes very hard and very unsuccessful. And I'd say, you know, Denise Martin, who was a star thoroughbreds, was at the time Gay's sole syndicator, and she moved on at that stage to go and work with Chris Waller. And Gay gave me opportunity to sort of, okay, Bruce, would you like to take over? You know, you're in sales. Start your own syndication company, off you go. And it was hugely challenging for me to go from zero to try and, you know, I suppose, replicate what Denise had done and built over so many years. And I think we have bought like 23 horses in our first year and eventually got there, but it wasn't for an enormous amount of work, a lot of sleepless nights, a very stressful sort of time. And let's just say, you know, when Henry knocked on the door, it didn't take too much convincing for me to get myself out of that situation and just go and try something new. So hats off to all the syndicators out there. That is a very, very challenging role, but such an important one for the Australian industry to blood new people in the game and give them a great experience.
Well, not, you know, a lot of trainers do it, but just putting your, well, you know, owing $1 million or on horses that, you know, realistically, it's not like a house that generally might hold most of its value or probably go up in value in that time, where, you know, you've got to sell it. There's interest to be paid on generally on those with the loans and so forth, that for a young person or anyone, that's stressful.
Yeah, exactly. And particularly if you take it, you know, I took it very personally, and I took it, you know, I was, you know, you got to buy stock to be able to sell it, but then you got to hold that stock. And if anything happens in the meantime, you know, it can really wipe out any sort of profit making, any profit making business, right? If you got something of high value that is then unsellable, you know, you're only an injury or a suspensory or a throat away from, you know, having done all that work, Tim and Justin, for absolutely zero, and in some cases, negative something, right? So awfully challenging business model, but you know, you look back at it and think, wow, I learned so much. I gained a lot of appreciation for how hard it was, but also, you know, learned to juggle things at that time and sell horses one by one, and you know, thankfully had a couple of decent ones out of them, but always want more, you know what I mean? And it's, I know from a syndication point of view and from any sort of selling shares and racehorses, you want them all to be quick, but unfortunately they're not. And it's about trying to keep people, just give them a great experience, I guess, through the whole thing until they do get their good one. And that's the key to it.
I think Newgate Farm was the busiest stud farm in Australia last season, or 2023. But when you got there, it wasn't, obviously Henry had fielded, risen up the ranks to a degree, but it's not like it was now. You've sort of played a fairly pivotal role, I would say, in that growth of Newgate.
Yeah, Henry's just an incredible operator. As you both know, just having dealt with him, he's a bit like Gay, right? And you've got Henry in conversation, you listen, right? He's just that kind of engaging person. He's always got his finger on the pulse. He's always pushing, driving, trying to be better, and he's built a very big stallion up business in the shortest probably time frame in Australian history. So again, surrounding myself with someone that's maybe before their time, you'd say, or maybe you'd just say exceptional. And he's challenged me and being someone that has always given me something to catch, I guess, you know what I mean? Try and lift my game. I think Henry's the kind of guy that would have got there to where he is now, not on his own, so to speak, but he would have found another way. Does that make sense, Tim and Justin? So I'm just very grateful to be on the journey with Henry and obviously Gavin and Catherine and Matthew and Wendy and Louise. Like, they're just an incredible group of very successful people and different businesses that have come together here, and they bounce off each other very well. And, you know, it's so funny that, like, we covered the most mares last year in Australia, but if you had been in our meetings at the, like, post-season review from 2023, which for most people would look at a success, the meeting afterwards was actually very straight and pretty hard-hitting, right, about how we need to be better. And Henry's just not a guy to look back or you know what I mean? He's just constantly looking forward and driving you. There's no sort of stop, pat on the back, let's enjoy this for 5 months and then worry about next season. You know, I'd say we came out of that season with more to do than what we had done, if that made sense. So it's just a very interesting mindset with Henry. He's always just going forward and pushing us harder.
Dealing with stallions, it's not like horses, full stop. It's not straightforward. And Newgate's not alone in this, of course, but obviously you're dealt a blow with, you know, fertility issues to Extreme Choice, and obviously Deep Field's now pensioned to is and would have been a very, you know, commercial stallion that I'm sure that's a blow to any farm. How do you cop those hits and try and move on?
Yeah, I mean, it's the toughest game, isn't it? I'm sure there's lots of tough industries out there, but whether you be a racehorse trainer, a racing owner, a breeder, a stallion owner, Tim, Justin, you will know full well. Tim is a breeder. I mean, it's the toughest game, right? Like, you're only ever a bad decision or a bad result away from a bad deal. I mean, you're just never out of the wood. You know what I mean? You're just never off and away. You've just got to constantly do your 1%ers every day and do your best. And you just know there's going to be something come up that's not going to be ideal. But so long as you know that if you just keep swimming, you'll get there in the end. Do you know what I mean? So I think to survive in this industry, we've all got that little bit of a thick skin and understanding that I've got to suck this one up because there's a good result coming. You just got to keep going. As long as you treat people well, as long as you look after people in the process as best you can under the different circumstances, you'll get there eventually, won't you? But whether it be stallion fertility or losing foals or x-ray issues or throw, you know, whatever it might be. There's always something, isn't there, Tim? Like, you just got to keep going.
In terms of the growth of Newgate from what it started off as to what it is now as one of Australia's leading farms, was there one particular moment or one particular decision in the processes that you've been involved in where you went, this has changed the farm and what it looks like going forward for the years to come, and it's going to turn into what it is now, essentially?
Oh, it's a very good question. I would frame it like this. I think it's constantly changing, like the way we're viewing the, you know, how to organize ourselves and operate through the 24 season is sort of in line with where the economy is right now and how you know, tough we can see this for small to medium sized breeders right now, et cetera, et cetera. So we, you know, Henry's incredible at trying to just adjust. And we're probably coming into a time where for us sort of our age group in that sort of 30s and 40s, we probably never had a downturn in the market, right? We've probably just been right, you know, riding the up the whole way. And we've never, you know, we've always had that benefit. We've never had that sort of downturn in the market. So how we manage that's going to be very important. But I think Henry just adjusts the whole time, Justin. The key is getting the right stallion prospects. We do a lot of work around, you know, what makes stallions good. It's not exact science, but we're trying to increase our chances all the time. We've also got the element of our business where when the Golden Slipper wins, if we don't already have control of that horse, we're not going to probably be able to buy him, right? We're always going to have a Coolmore or a Yulong or a Fiora or that kind of farm, these international sort of businesses where they might have a different business model to ours and can therefore pay, you know, higher multiples. So I think the biggest advantage we've been able to get in the market is being able to try and identify those stallions before they win those key races. And I think Henry's had a huge impact on that at the yearling sales, at the weaning sales. Breeding horses like King's Gambit, for instance, are really important for us to have them in the system early. And then, of course, using time data to find these horses before they go and win their Group 1s, like we have with Osmosis and like we have with Extreme Choice and like we have maybe standing a horse like Tassel, where the market maybe didn't appreciate him as much as we did because we saw how elite he was on times, even though he wasn't able to show that given his racing was cut short by injury. So that's probably where we've really done well in the past and hope to do well in the future.
Every year at this time of year, service fees are going to be announced in the next, over the, probably the next 4 to 6 weeks. And of course, breeders say the service fees are always too high no matter what they are. But in part, it probably comes down to how much stallion farms have to pay to acquire these stallions. Have you got a view of perhaps where the overall stallion fee market might go this year, given the economy is sort of slowing?
I think you hit the nail on the head. I think we've got an adjustment coming. And, you know, I sort of touched on it earlier. You know, how we play the next season, two seasons, three seasons as stallion owners, I think is going to have a big impact on how many breeders we can keep in the game. And that is something we're very mindful of coming into 2024. You know, how do we help those breeders stay in the game? The fact is the cost, it's not just the stallion service fees, the cost of producing a yearling has become, it's been like building costs, right? I mean, it's doubled probably the last 3 years. You know, where it was costing people $20,000 to get from utero to a yearling sale, it's now costing them $40,000. Okay, well, what kind of sale do you need to go to get into to get your 40 grand back, plus your service fee back, plus the value of the mare, you know, broken over three seasons? Well, next minute you're looking at 20, 30 grand fee, 70 grand, then you've got the value of the mare, 80, 90 grand, then you want to make some money on the whole thing, right? Because you've had the other three mares that didn't go and foal that year or whatever it was. So, you know, you're wanting to sort of, on a 20, 30 grand fee, you're wanting to sort of average 100 grand. What sale averages 100 grand? You know, over 100 grand, right? 100 or over. Easter, Magic Millions, like Melbourne and Classic, and they can only take so much of the foal crop, but we're getting a reduced foal crop, but a foal crop that's more and more commercially bred. So, you know, sale placement and getting your horse in the right sales is becoming very difficult for breeders too. So I think there's an element where we're all going to have to just be very mindful of the quality of mare we're breeding. We're going to have to be very mindful of how we set service fees so that breeders can actually do well. But we've also got to remain really positive as a group and say, listen, prize money is fantastic. The yearling market's worth about $500 million. It's a huge amount of money that you can have your share of, but you've just got to be very mindful and really deal in high quality stuff or quality stuff to make sure you get into that yearling market and get your fair piece of it at a break even or obviously a better position.
You've obviously taken a bit of a step back from your duties at Newgate as well and moved to the Gold Coast. Would you be able to explain the move up to Australia's sunny state, I should say?
Yeah, thanks, Justin. Yeah, I will say that I think it's been a great move for, like, I've got three young children, so it's been really a decision based around my family at the time. Initially, Henry and myself and the team probably weren't sure how it would work or if it could work. But thanks to Henry, he gave me an opportunity for 12 months just to see if it could work and how it might work. And I feel like, you know, it's working really well. And obviously I'll be able to do go back and work with Gay and a great friend of mine, Adrian Bott, as well, and sort of have that, wear the two hats essentially, and plus do a couple other things outside of that. So really it was a family decision. But in the end, it's actually looked like a really good decision for Newgate too. You know, like where I was general manager at the time, you know, Jim Carrey's come in and taken over that stud manager's position. And he's just been such a huge, hugely positive influence for the farm and the way we raise our horses and the way just the team, you know, like just getting the team around them to make sure that everything from covering to yearling sales and even racetrack now is just done perfectly. So I feel like we've ended up in a really nice position. Gold Coast move was very much just about, you know, lifestyle, spending some time with the children as they grow up. And thankfully with flights and things these days, it's worked very well so far.
Obviously that move sort of led to the establishment of Kestrel Thoroughbreds, which we see a lot in the sales results, which is your sort of business. And you're obviously, yeah, working closely with Adrian Bott and Gay, of course, but I think Adrian's getting the credit he deserves now as a trainer and obviously won two slippers and Lady of Camelot last weekend and Storm Boy and so forth. But you've been close to Adrian for, you know, a lot of years.
Yeah, Adrian and I actually worked together. Like, I actually gave Adrian the job as a bloodstock assistant when he first came on with Gay. And then when I went to go and work for Newgate, I actually offered him the Roundtable Racing. I said, listen, do you want to take this over? And probably not a good friend thing to do given how much stress I had, but I think he'd seen what I'd done and what he could learn from it and could have done a lot much better job than I did. And it was at that actual moment where it was like Adrian said to Gay, well, I'm going to do this with you, do Roundtable Racing. And Gay said, don't do that, do this. You know, I need someone, you know, you're the guy. I've got a lot of faith in you, the guy that can take, you know, run this business with me and take over. And to Adrian's credit, it's a great benefit the way you can walk into a stable. It's got boxes at Randwick and the branding that Gay has, but it's also a huge amount of pressure, you know, tenfold what I was dealing with at Roundtable Racing in terms of, you know, he owns that business. Make no mistake, right? It's Gay's on a salary like I am, if that makes sense. So he is, you know, had to go and absorb all that huge amount of debt sale time through the first 3 years where, you know, people may not have known him or couldn't at that time give him the credit he deserved because they didn't understand how much, you know, how good he was going to be or how much he knew. He really just kept buying yearlings, made sure he put himself in a position to get the good stock into a stable. And every year, I think everyone can see for themselves, he's just improving things. And with that has come an improved level of support. And, you know, he's better positioned this year than he was last year. And you could have said the same last year. So hopefully that continues for him. But again, guys, surrounding yourself with exceptional people. And he is the hardest working person I've ever come across. And his ability to absorb pressure, his ability to keep my, he'd be a great man to have alongside you in battle, I can tell you, because he just keeps marching. He's an incredible guy. And as you see in his post-race interviews, he's just incredibly measured, cool, calm, collected, and someone I really greatly admire.
When someone says champion two-year-old or golden slipper, Tullock Lodge is the first thing to pop into a lot of people's minds. Could you have imagined that Tullock Lodge actually get to this position where they are now? And although they've been in that position as arguably, number one trainer of two-year-olds for a while now, arguably this has been their best year they've had, and again topped it off with a golden slipper win last week.
It's been pretty deliberate with the two-year-olds. I think, as Adrian sort of mentioned in his post-winning interview on Saturday with Lady of Camelot, he said, like, I was sort of against it a little bit, you know, the two-year-old stuff, because he wanted to enjoy his training, the older horses and the stays and that sort of thing, which he still does very well, I must say. But, it, you know, if you look back this year, I think he's had 22 wins now. I think they've won or placed in every single two-year-old stakes race in Sydney this year, which is unheard of, right? Just shows their consistency across the colts and the fillies. And I think they've won 9 stakes races now. Last year they had 36 winners with 8 stakes winners, so they look like they're on track to beat that. But on the 4 years before that, Justin, they had an average of 21 winners and 2 stakes winners, or 2.5 stakes winners. So, yes, they continued to get a good number of two-year-old winners up, but the last two seasons it's just gone bang, bang. And that was very deliberate. He set up a very good two-year-old system with the view that, you know, you have to get them educated early on racetracks. He initially had it set up at Goulburn. Now he's got it at Hawkesbury, where he's got these horses coming into Randwick, and they're very well educated, very forward. And he's been able to get them up and going. And this season, I mean, we may never get sticks in a slipper again, but hopefully we can replicate as much of the system as we can, like we did last season, just keep, you know, trying to keep ourselves in the mix. And of course, if you have the best two-year-olds, a lot of the time those horses will go on and be amongst the best three-year-olds, so it sort of covers those two off. And you know, I suppose from a commercial point of view, two-year-old racing, two-year-old success is where a lot of the commercial value is added. So if you can be in and amongst there, you'll get a lot of the commercial investors will be in there to support you as well.
You sort of touched on it a couple of times during this interview, but the buying process, you know, and you said Adrian's put his neck on the line, but there's a big team. There's Gay and Claudia Miller and yourself, and they're all around the sales, and you're driving the cart around. And, you know, it amazed me. I saw between Christmas and New Year, Gay went down to New Haven Park, which was not easy to get to, let me tell you. I got lost going there. To and from. Yeah. You know, between Christmas and New Year, when she could be putting her feet up, that's obviously a lot of hard work, but there's also a lot of decision makers there. How does that decision making process work, Bruce, when you decide to, okay, we're bidding on this and this is the budget and what we're doing with it?
Yeah, we've got the great benefit scale, and Adrian, you know, his appetite to buy yearlings at scale. So that's a huge asset to us, and very much he will, you know, he's the end of what gets bought and what doesn't, because at the end of the day, he's putting his neck on the line for the stock. A lot of the time we'll come together on horses and be very strong on them. At other times where Gay might say, listen, I really love this one, and you guys might be lukewarm, but I really love this one, Adrian will just back her in and say, listen, she's bought so many great horses and is such an incredible trainer of two-year-olds that he'll just back her essentially. So that's it in a nutshell. I'd say most of the time it's a collaboration between Claudia, Emma, Gay, myself, Adrian. Everyone's looking at them. Of course, Dr. Greg Nash has to vet them to pass. And in addition to that, you know, if Gay really loves one, Adrian will back it to the hill.
As I have with quite a few guests on this podcast, I've been fortunate enough to go around and look at horses with people, and including yourself, Bruce. And it was interesting going around at the Magic Millions two-year-old sale last November or October, it would have been. And you said, oh, this is a nice horse, very nice horse. You'd be happy to buy it for, say, 100. But it just didn't fit the Gay and Adrian model, or, you know, Sydney is so competitive, I guess you're not willing to compromise on that criteria that's obviously serving Tullock Lodge well.
Yeah, no, just trying to get it as right as you can, Tim. And I really enjoy the aspect of trying to find the elite horses. You know, we're always constantly learning, and it's one of those things too where you get your repetitions up all the time, aren't you? You know, the more repetitions you can get in, the better. I would say on that, I think mare sales are a great way to get your eye in for anyone out there that's looking to build their eye on you know, what makes good horses run fast. The mare sales, you'll see a cross section. You know, at the yearling sales, you're trying to foresee what they might do. And in 2 or 3 years' time, you might be able to review your notes to see where you were right, where you were wrong, why you were right, and why you were wrong. But the mare sales, they've done it on the track or not done it on the track. They're either slow, sort of fast, or fast. And you can go and look at those mares at the sale and be like, wow, okay, I can see she's got that with through a hocks or that low hock or the lovely short cannons, or she's, you know, drops away behind. You can see why she couldn't, you know, get out the gates quick and that kind of thing. So for any budding young bloodstock agent out there, or someone that's just interested to learn more about that, the mare sales are a great tool for you.
Sure, I'll back that up. Jimmy Onlola, who's a sponsor of this podcast, has also said the same thing about legs and different things and prove and disprove theories all the time at the mare sales.
Yes.
Kestrel Thoroughbreds, do you class yourself as a bloodstock agent? It is a bloodthirsty sport, and it can be nice in the back. You're too nice to be a bloodstock agent, aren't you, Bruce?
No, I don't like it at all. I really genuinely want to see everyone do well. Happy to work in with anyone with our stable. Like, genuinely, like, you see how many different agents we have on there. A lot of time we buy horses, I don't even sign my name down. Honestly, Tim, I just want to see the best horses get in the stable. Happy to work with all agents. And you know, it's Tim. Like, I mean, it's a great group of people out there just doing their best in the most, one of the most challenging industries in the world. So, you know, good luck to all of us, and where we can, we work together.
When actually looking at a yearling at the sales, is it a pedigree or the physical type of the yearling that you look at first?
I'd say physical type is what ends up getting the horse bought, Justin. And I think then the pedigree will sort of just advise you where you might need to be in price range, you know. But I think you can help yourself a lot on pedigree. Like, I think, you know, buying proven size, buying proven broodmare size, buying out of mares that could gallop a bit. I've got no doubt that my ratings on type are probably influenced a little bit by, okay, that's a high percent play based on statistics given that horse's profile. So a bit of that comes into it for sure. I think pedigree can really help increase your chances of success, but also, you know, just make sure you don't overpay for something that might not be a high probability chance on paper. You know, a lot of the time you can fall in love with the first crop yearling by an unproven stallion from a mare that's at 8-fold and done nothing, and you just think to yourself, wow, okay, well, I mean, you just got to make sure you're not getting in there and bidding 300,000-400,000, where if the same horse is by since out of a very fast group on a mare, you're happy to bid that kind of money. Does that make sense? So I think it just helps you with your values pedigree a lot, and making sure you don't overpay in you know, with what's relevant to what percent chance they are of actually making it.
Obviously, working alongside the likes of Adrian and Gay as well for a long period of time, has that ever sparked any ambition to want to go out and train on yourself at all, or is that something you haven't really thought about?
No, I think one day when I'm like 80 and I'm just like cruising around on the Gold Coast, and like I might have a horse and work or something just to prove that I want to just get a winner somewhere. Do you know what I mean? Just for a bit of fun, get me out of the house and go and train one in the morning and chat to a few people or whatever else. Maybe, but no. At scale, I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy, training, I can tell you.
You've got three beautiful children with your wife Tash, who you met at Tullock Lodge, and she's a former ANZ colleague and certainly helped me through my early period here at ANZ, and been here for quite a while now. But when I didn't know anything, and arguably I still don't, but she certainly helped me, and I'm forever grateful for that to Tash. But where do you see Team Slade heading next? What's the next goal?
Yeah, well, I'd say you were very kind of Tash too, mate, and she always speaks really high of you. And I think, I mean, you have stood the test of the time in the role and the game. I mean, I would say you're probably one of the most, you know, in terms of familiar faces at every sale, at every key racing event, mate, you are there. So it's a real credit to you and the profile you've built in the racing game. And you're a guy that you will pick up the phone to a lot of different people in the industry, and not many good people I reckon have the strike rate of you would to number of calls to, you know, answers on the first time round. So I think that says a lot about you, and people are always happy to pick up the phone to you, you know. On Tash, you know, he's been hugely, we're a team for sure, and hugely influential on me. I think she's really, you know, as you know, Tim, into her sort of personal growth, into her, you know, improving self as a person all the time. And I think that's really helped. A lot of your value to others starts with, you know, how you value yourself and having your own self-worth. And Tasha's worked very hard with me around my own personal growth, trying to improve myself as a person. And I think as my sort of the value up, you know, my own sort of value on myself has grown, so has it helped me, you know, outside of you know, our own team and in the industry. So no, we just want to keep improving ourselves, hopefully raise a really nice three kids that can make their way in the world and do well, but also, you know, pull others up with them. So that's the goal, and it's probably the most challenging probably the most challenging role of any.
I always feel after a sale I should go to your place and just go spend a week on the Tash Health Farm.
It'd be don't worry. I need it as much as you.
Well, so at the time of recording, it was announced yesterday that Platinum Jubilee is going to go through the sale, and obviously a half-sister to the slipper winner, Lady of Camelot, and I don't know how many million she's going to be worth, but she's going to be worth a lot of money, which was the idea of setting up. You did set up a filly syndicate called the Valerie Syndicate, and she's a member of that first year. Hopefully it continues on that success, but great year one for you.
Yeah, and I hope it goes this way a bit. You know, I hope that if you provide the right niche and idea around why you might go and buy a group of horses, I really hope that for all trainers and syndicators and agents that we can sort of build more of this pre-raising, you know, have owners support us before the sale as opposed to having to go in there and everyone putting themselves under so much pressure to get horses done afterwards. This is a partnership that was $2 million based on trying to buy like high commercial, two-year-old speed runners and physicals and pedigrees. Thankfully had a really good first year on the back of an incredible support from people that were willing to put their money up based on, you know, where we saw the opportunity as opposed to what the actual horse was. So it took an enormous amount of faith for them to do that. I'm so glad it looks like it's going to pay off year one. And thankfully we've got year two and year three coming as well now, Tim. So yeah, hopefully Valerie kicked off another couple of partnerships on the back of this as well, but it'd be something I'd be pushing all trainers, agents, racing managers to do, you know, find the niche, find the opportunity, and then build your group. And it's really enjoyable too. They've enjoyed coming through the process of buying them, being at the sale as we're bidding on them, understanding how that all works too has been a great thing. And Platinum Jubilee's year one, so she's going to pay for a couple of years of it, touch wood. And you know, we're not going to get that lucky every year, but we'll be trying.
And I thought this is a time to lead into, as I touched on, Jimmy on Waller, Avesta Bloodstock, proudly sponsors the Business of Bloodstock podcast. Thanks, Jimmy. And so one segment is a share in success. I know, hopefully the ATO is not listening if you haven't declared this, Bruce, but you know, you have traded a few horses, and I was trying to think, one I know of is Oh My Sword that you might have had a share in and, you know, bought and traded. Is there a horse that sticks out to you that you and Tash put your money up and got a bit of a result out of?
Yeah, I would just suggest to everyone out there, you know, the people especially like ourselves that work in the game, the people in noms and teams and things, like, you know, try and get a bit of trade going like you do, Tim. You know, do that thing on the side. Use your wage to fund your lifestyle, and then use your the time you spend in the game each day and your insight to try and get yourself a bit of trade going on the side. We have mostly invested in stallion shares and in trading mares. Those are the sort of two avenues myself and Tash have gone. I like the idea of stallion shares where you can get them paid off in 3 years and then you just sit on them and they generate your income at no extra cost from there on in. And I think if you're a breeder, I would strongly advise looking at investment in stallion equity. Mare trading has helped us buy our first house. Mare trading is a wonderful thing in that you can add value to mares through service fees, to finding the right mates, to hit the right stallions on the up that might have a bit of demand around them. But you don't have to actually pay that service fee until they sold. So you've got to pay for the mare, you add the value through the service fee, you go and trade the mare, it's only really cost you the cost of the mare. And then, of course, you know, the commission on mare sales is 3.5% versus, you know, 10% or more for the other stuff. You don't have to worry about x-rays. You don't have to worry about throats. So it's a lot less risk as well. So it's a nice way to trade, is trading mares. The best result was one that myself, Henry Field and Sam Fairgrey bought a mare out of, I want to say, Tamworth, owned by Mr. T. Moses. I thought it was Henry's uncle when I rang him. I said, listen, Mr. Moses, we've got this mare. We've got a half-brother that we think goes pretty well. We'd like to offer you X. And he duly sold. She's by Flying Spur. She was a half-sister to Russian Revolution, who then came out and won a couple of Group 1s. We put her in Folded Deep Field, and I think she sold for about 700,000, so it was a huge result. But little did we know that her first foal would be Acer, a Group 2 winner. Tory Byrne Stud, who then bought her, then sent her to Invincible, and she produced a horse called Home Affairs at her second foal. And her third foal made about $1 million. So we did well, and Tory Byrne are doing even better. Fair play to Brett Cornish and Mel Copeland. They just buy, they deal in quality stock and bought very well there, that's for sure.
Has T. Moses been willing to sell you a mare ever since? Probably, possibly not.
So it wasn't, it wasn't actually Henry's uncle in the end. But no, he was very understanding. And to be fair, for every one of those, there's been four or five others where the half-brother hasn't popped up, Tim, as we'd hoped. So, you know, it all, you just got to buy at scale and you know, those big wins are the ones that really can make a difference to things, can't they?
And I think that's a good wrap-up of share and success. As Jimmy said, and our previous guest, Marcus Heritage, you've just got to be involved, and that's what I'll be telling the auction houses when I go to apply for credit this year at the mayor's sale.
And that's a great thing, isn't it? You know, it's amazing. If you have a good reputation in the industry and start small, but, you know, these guys, you know, the sales companies are willing to back you. Go in there with the right people. And if you can have those small wins along the way, make sure you get the debt paid off quickly. They'll keep backing you, and that big result will come.
And just a quick one to finish off, Bruce. We have this fast five segment. So just a quick five questions that Tim and I will ask. And not necessarily to do with racing, but just a little bit of a get to know you segment. So first one here of the fast five, do you have any hobbies outside of racing at all?
Love sport, love exercise, love NRL, AFL.
Not there's much time to, you know, the sales season's pretty hectic and then breeding season, but have you got a favourite holiday destination when you do get a chance to take a breather?
Favourite holiday? I'm very lucky to live in a great holiday destination. So the flip side of that, I think, is I love going down to Newgate in the winter with the family for a bit of country living, riding ponies, you know, feeding out horses and just being on the land. It's great.
Doing the sales circuit, obviously, we travel around Australia, New Zealand, and occasionally the world as well. Is there a favourite restaurant that you'd recommend to any listeners out there?
Gee, we're lucky, aren't we, too, with that. I would say crazily priced, but if you want a bit of luxury and you've had a big result and you want to treat yourself, Mimi's in Coogee in Sydney is next level.
Breeding season or sales season, which do you prefer?
Sales season. Love looking at horses. Just my favourite thing to do.
And kicking back on a Saturday night on the couch, popcorn in hand, what's the Netflix suggestion?
I'm a big sort of Tour de France Unchained, Drive to Survive, you know, Michael Jordan's, that kind of thing. You know, I love that insight into those incredible athletes, incredible people. So that's what I'll be going, guys.
Thanks very much, Bruce, for coming on the Business of Bloodstock podcast. I've really enjoyed this chat for about an hour or so. As I expected, you're really informative and interesting and great backstory. So credit to you, Bruce.
Guys, appreciate your time very much. Keep up the great work and look forward to seeing you at the next sale soon.